This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Well, deadly flooding in Rio de Janeiro has raised questions about whether the city is equipped to host the 2016 Olympics.
Melbourne's main streets became raging torrents as the city was drenched by nearly 30 millimetres in less than 60 minutes.
Back here at home tonight, an update on the historic flooding that left parts of southern New England underwater this past week.
Global warming? From Rhode Island to Rio to Queensland, 100-year floods, 200-year floods, all-time record rains happening all over the world, and as TV tells it, everyone is just a freak storm or the power of El Nino. Who would have guessed? Maybe Radio EcoShock listeners 3 years ago, as I interviewed scientist Noah Diffenbaugh about extreme rainfall events.
And in 2005, your team released one of the most detailed climate model predictions for North America. Can you tell us about that?
Well, we found that elevated greenhouse gas concentrations substantially increase the frequency of extreme precipitation events and also the contribution of those events to the total annual precipitation. So not only do the heaviest events become more frequent as greenhouse gas concentrations rise, but they also represent a larger fraction of the total precipitation that comes during the year.
But you won't hear any of that from TV weather reporters. George Mason University's Center for Climate Change Communication released a study of weathercasters. Sure, they talk about climate change to say over and over again it isn't happening. 63% of weather people told the university that natural causes are behind any warming. Another 27% say warming isn't happening at all. It's a big scam. Only the oil men rank higher for skepticism.
So my message, first of all, to the public out there is, frankly, from a flooding standpoint, the worst is still ahead of us.
Do I hear global warming? And who are these doubters with a massive audience? Just half of them have a degree in meteorology. A handsome or pretty face is the main job qualification. We'd have to dig deep to find a single one with scientific training in climate science. In fact, these would-be experts hardly get the next day's weather right, much less the expectations for the next decade. And their corporate employers, running all those oil and car ads, don't mind a bit if the big silence about global warming turns into a smear. Sooner or later, humans standing in the latest floodwaters or fire are going to accept the big changes come, and they are not going to remember the TV liars kindly.
Keep a clean nose, wash your clean clothes, you don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows.
Our next guest says humans are very close to climate collapse. David W. Orr is a distinguished professor of environmental studies and politics at Oberlin College in Ohio. He's been a pioneer in greening higher education. He advises many leaders and foundations. His latest book is Down to the Wire, Confronting Climate Collapse. Dr. Orr, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you. Nice to be here.
David, what does it mean that people don't believe in climate disruption, even as floods and storms and heat waves surround them?
Well, climate change is somebody once called it the perfect problem. And it is complicated. The science is difficult to master. And we live in a country where 40% or some such number don't believe in evolution, which is well-established science. So I think it's a complicated thing. It is also, in many people's minds, threatens to disrupt the American way of life and make living harder and so forth. So it's an easy thing to deny. And then the time horizon, the big changes ahead are years or decades into the future, and so it's easy enough to procrastinate. So it hits us really where we're weakest. And so the deniers are, and here in Oberlin today, it's a lovely spring day. It's in the mid-70s, and the sun is shining, and so it's easy enough, I think, to simply dismiss the whole thing if you're so inclined.
And it's been the same in Australia. There's been a wild revival of climate denial there while they export even more coal, and that's after a 10-year drought wiped out their wheat exports and inferno bushfires killed hundreds. What makes you think humans can wake up and react in time?
Well, a good bit of the denial is, if you use the attorney's rule of thumb of follow the money, and you find behind the people with big megaphones and access to the airwaves on television and radio and so forth, and the written press, you find a good bit of coal and oil money paying for the denial. There's not a mystery here. They've put a lot of effort into this in the United States and Australia and Europe and so forth, and there isn't any particular mystery to why denial is flourishing. And then it requires, the media doesn't help us much in the United States because for example, in the spring from last year on, it was a little bit cooler in the northeast part of the United States where I live. But other parts of the world were going through weather extremes. And so the fact of the matter is the science on one side coincides rather well with the anecdotal evidence that you describe on the other side. It's very consistent with it, and yet the media doesn't much report that. And so you have these odd things of James Imhoff, the senator from Oklahoma, building igloos on the Capitol grounds to mock Al Gore, while, in fact, the temperatures at the North Pole were running considerably warmer than they normally would. Pressure differential had pushed a lot of cold air south. But that in itself doesn't mean anything. 2009 was the second hottest year on record, and the past decade was the hottest decade ever recorded. But the media doesn't help us. It doesn't give us, it gives us little snapshots of opinions, but it doesn't consistently cover the entire planet. And so it's fertile ground for deniers to simply turn their back on the scientific evidence.
Okay, we jumped right into the deep end there. Let's back up a bit to understand your path into the book. Many of our listeners are college students, and that is where your personal Green Revolution began, it seems to me. Can you tell us a little bit about your efforts at Oberlin College?
Well, let me say two things. One is, beginning in the middle 1990s, we set out to create a model of a green building powered entirely by sunlight that emitted no waste product, water or otherwise. And that's now that project was completed about 10 years ago. That's the Adam Joseph Lewis Center. It's still, I think, the only entirely solar-powered, zero-discharge building on a U.S. college campus. And that's been a terrific laboratory for the study of sustainability. What we did essentially was to downsize problems of energy and landscape and water into a single manageable acre and a quarter site. Second thing I'd say is that's the template now for a much bigger project, 20 times the scale, to get the college and the city of Oberlin to carbon neutrality. We're one of 18 global projects selected by the Clinton Climate Initiative and designated as carbon positive projects. And we're working to establish a large green belt around the city and rebuild a good bit of the downtown and do the whole thing also, as we did with the Lewis Center, as an educational venture, but in this case involving both college students and high school kids, as well as students from two-year colleges and the local vocational school. So those are two things underway, and there's actually a good bit of activity at Oberlin. It's a terrifically fertile place, and the students here are wonderfully ingenious and very committed to environmental quality, and so this is a good place, and there's a whole lot of things happening.
Last week on Radio EcoShock, we ran a special program on super low-energy construction techniques. There was passive house and net zero projects. How important is building design in helping to prevent more damaging climate disruption?
Well, buildings are said to be responsible for about 40% of the U.S. carbon footprint. So buildings are a huge part of the future prospect here. We're supposed to build more than in the next 50 years than we built in the past 5,000. And if we do that carelessly and badly, effectively the ball game's over. I mean, climate, we wouldn't survive the results of powering those buildings. On the other side of it, the building revolution that's sponsored by people at the U.S. Green Building Council and the Living Building Challenge and American Institute of Architects and pioneered by people like Bob Birkenbeil, the architect, and Ed Masria, and Bill McDonough, and lots of other folks. There's a revolution in design. We know how to make buildings effectively powered by sunshine and make them terrific buildings that work very well for occupants as well as financially for the people that pay the bills. So the revolution in design has really already happened. What we need now is to extend that so that building environmentally responsibly becomes the default setting. It's just the normal way that we build instead of the exceptional way we build. And the U.S. Green Building Council, Rick Fedrizian, Scott Horst, and all the people that work at the USGBC have done a terrific job at making this part of the environmental landscape. It's one of the great success stories of the environmental movement.
David Orr, you were also part of a team of people who helped prepare a climate action plan for President Obama. Can you tell us a little about that?
Well, a group of us met back in 2007 or thereabouts as part of the President's Council on Sustainable Development that had flourished in the Clinton years and had gone dormant in the George Bush years. And one of the ideas that came out of that meeting, 2007, was an idea of developing an action plan for the next U.S. administration, be it Democrat or Republican, that would focus on the first 100 days of the administration in the belief that there was no time to waste and that climate and energy policy, which are flip sides of the same coin, was kind of a linchpin of every other issue, whether it be foreign policy or economic or environmental or whatever else. But if you got that right, you get lots of other things right. Bill Becker, who had worked previously for the U.S. Department of Energy for a number of years and a terrific administrator, was the executive director for the project. We met with most of the campaign teams and candidates, including the transition teams for both McCain and Obama. And then after the election, met with the Obama transition group and passed on the plan. Obviously, the first 100 days of the Obama administration has come and gone. They did a number of things that we and other groups and organizations recommended, but it was not the highest priority for them. Healthcare became the highest priority, and that the rest, as they say, is history. That doesn't mean the issue is over by any stretch of the imagination. There is movement in Congress and in the administration to press ahead on climate issues. Last week, the administration announced final rules for the auto efficiency, and so there's movement across the board, but we were focused primarily on the first 100 days. Bill Becker is heading up a second effort, PCAP Part 2, to focus on what's happened since the first year and where do we go from here on out.
Okay, well, I want to switch a little bit here. Gaia theorist James Lovelock has just given another disturbing interview to the BBC in London. Lovelock claims it's too late. We shouldn't waste our money on things like wind energy, but we should spend it all on adapting to the inevitable climate shift. How do you answer that?
Well, James Lovelock is certainly one of the great scientists of our time, arguably the best independent scientist in the world. And so you have to weigh his words carefully. And he's got a great batting average. He's been right about a lot of things in the past. From my perspective, I'd say two things. One is, I don't believe that it can be said authoritatively that it is, in fact, too late. The title of my book captures what I believe to be true, and which is to say, we are going down to the wire. We're getting close to points of no return, but we're not there yet. And so, personally, I'm not willing to say that it's too late. The second comment I'd make is that adaptation to what? Do we adapt to 392 parts per million CO2, which is where we are now, or to 400 or 450 or 500 or whatever the future levels could go to? And so adaptation to me seems rather like getting a mop and mopping up water in your bathroom instead of turning the faucet off in your overflowing bathtub. The smart thing to do, it seems to me, would be to put all of your efforts that you can into lowering carbon emissions, improving energy efficiency, making the transition to a renewable energy world, instead of trying to clean up the mess or trying to adapt to what is clearly a moving target, a moving and worsening target. So the first priority, in my judgment, is urgently to, with really wartime urgency, for all the reasons Jim Lovelock says, to lowering carbon emissions and getting them back to levels. Bill McKibben has made quite an organization out of 350 as the target goal. But in fact, we have to probably go eventually, and sooner than later, back below 300 parts per million, closer to the pre-industrial level of 280 parts per million, with what is got to be seen as kind of wartime urgency.
Another worry proposed by Lovelock is that climate change may not develop as a steady rise in either temperature or sea levels. It might happen as sudden jumps and reversals. He says previous climate records show a long-term heating can include intervals, perhaps even decades or more, of some slight cooling as well. Given all the global cooling nonsense from last winter's snowfall in the U.S., do you think climate action plans can survive unsteady weather?
Well, that's a good question. I think what's needed is rather extraordinary leadership at all levels of society, including the media. And I think people, for example, at News Corp that keep folks like Glenn Beck on the radio or on the airwaves in prime time and make sure Rush Limbaugh makes his $400 million contract, do a real disservice, because in the middle of the biggest crisis humankind's ever faced, there are people who serve to confuse, muddy the water, befuddle people, who don't have the time to study the climate issue as a science. And if it's a crime to yell fire in a crowded theater that is not burning, it's a much more serious crime, I think, to prevent people from yelling fire in a theater that is burning. And so I think there has to be a really quite extraordinary level of leadership, starting with the president and working through corporate heads, including corporations that are selling, you know, the vendors of fossil fuels. They clearly know that something is wrong. They can study the scientific record much the same way that you and I can. But the parallel case, it appears to me, to be is the kind of the cigarette case, where executives knew that they were selling an addictive, harmful substance, and yet went on for years denying it. And the same is certainly true now. The scientific consensus around human impacts on climate is overwhelming. So I think it's going to take an extraordinary level of leadership to turn this around.
I raised Lovelock's worries about the irregular progression of climate change partly because of another paper almost unknown to the general public. A theoretical ecologist at the University of California, Davis, named Alan Hastings, says that climate tipping points may not be predictable at all. According to his work, there may be no signals or warnings before a radical shift. For example, temperatures could just go up rather suddenly and stay there. Do you think that could happen?
Well, I really don't know, and I've not read Alan Hastings' paper, but I think it underscores a bigger issue that years ago a climate scientist said that climate is like an angry beast and we're poking it with sticks. And the record apparently does show that climate can change suddenly. The scientific evidence appears to be fairly consistent on that, or has become fairly consistent. And that being the case, it's all the more imperative that we create prudent low or zero carbon energy futures with a wartime sense of urgency. There's not a moment to spare here. And if there was only one chance in 100 that Alan Hastings' paper is correct, or one chance in 1,000, think of that level of risk relative to a decision to get into a car and ride in a car, or better yet, put your grandchildren in a car where the risk was a fatal accident was 1 in 100 or 1 in 1,000. No rational, loving parent or grandparent would do that. And yet the denialists are in a position of asking us to run those kinds of risks, or much greater risks. Frankly, they're closer to 1 to 1, because you can't entirely prove exactly what will happen. But Alan Hastings' work and Jim Lovelock's work shows, or demonstrates, as many others have, is that this is what's called a nonlinear system, where surprises and nasty surprises are part of the way the system works. It's rather like the old saying about the straw that breaks the camel's back. It's the last final increment that breaks the back. It's the last little change that forces the system across the tipping point. And climate appears to be that kind of system.
Well, getting to your own book, Down to the Wire, Confronting Climate Collapse, what do you mean by climate collapse?
Well, I mean the collapse of the system that we've become accustomed to. Human society grew up effectively in the only paradise that we've ever known, which geologists call the Holocene. It's the past roughly 12,000 years in which climate was fairly abnormally benign compared to the rest of global climate history. And that's the era in which we became what we are, human. That's the era in which all of our art and poetry and music and history and civilizations around the planet grew up. That's what made us what we are. And in that era, the level of greenhouse gases, or in this case carbon dioxide, never went above roughly 280 parts per million. Now we're already at 392 parts per million, with consequences that we are only beginning to imagine. And so we're effectively evicting ourselves from this paradise that we call the Holocene. And so the collapse I'm referring to is a self-perpetuating collapse that concerns the entire planet. And for our purposes, it would be effectively permanent. Carbon, I start the book with a quote from the geophysicist at the University of Chicago, David Archer, that basically describes carbon staying in the atmosphere for a long time. And so the changes that we're bringing are going to be with us effectively for a very long time. Bill McKibben has a new book coming out called Earth, spelled E-A-A-R-T-H, and the extra A is an indicator of the fact we've already made the Earth into a different planet. It's not the one that we've known over the ages. This is now a hotter, more capricious world that we've created. Exactly how that plays out, we don't know. So the collapse I'm referring to is essentially the collapse of the carbon or the climate system that we've known throughout our entire evolution as Homo sapiens.
Well, we're starting to run out of time, and I really recommend that listeners get your book because there's just so many things that we've missed that we haven't had time to cover. But as we wrap up, what message would you like to leave with our listeners? And I'm hoping you'll give us kind of a two-part answer. Your comments for those old enough to remember a stable climate, and then maybe something for college students who are growing up in this time of climate disruption.
Well, the book ends where I'd like to end the interview, and that is on the message of hope. And hope is not the same as optimism. Optimism means that you're going to win the game and you don't have to do anything. And on the other end of the extreme, it's a caution. Don't go into despair that we've changed things and it's late in the ballgame. But neither optimism nor despair require you to do anything. It's only in hope that change or to act becomes an imperative. If you're hopeful, you have to do something. You cannot sit passive. And hope, I define in the book, is a verb with its sleeves rolled up. And so the message really to young and old is get engaged, get active, begin to do things. Help your own communities make the transition to carbon neutrality. If you're a homeowner, do that with your own house. If you're a college student, get engaged with campus environmental groups. Join the Climate Action Plan and get your college to pledge and move toward carbon neutrality. So this is not a time to be passive or despairing and not optimistic. It is a time to be hopeful, but that requires everyone, young and old, all of us, to act and act intelligently and strategically to begin to do the things that lower our carbon footprint dramatically and very quickly.
We've been talking with David W. Orr. He's a green pioneer, teacher, and advisor with Ohio's Oberlin College. His latest book is Down to the Wire, Confronting Climate Collapse. Find out more at davidworr.com. David, thank you so much for lending us your valuable time.
Thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.